Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. Hi there, and thanks for joining us. Lovely to have you with us wherever you are, through Australia and across Radio Australia. It's become something of a cliche, variously phrased by Dr. Johnson in his Life of Boswell as a decent provision for the poor is the true test of civilization, and more recently by the martyred German pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer, quote, the test of the morality of a society is what it does for its children. However you've heard that phrase, with a new parliament convening in Canberra this week and a new government committed to change, the question of what sort of change is of more than passing interest. ACOS, the Australian Council of Social Services, have already welcomed the speech by new Federal Housing Minister Kevin Andrews and calling for improvements to the supply of affordable housing. This week, they'll be hosting a policy forum in Sydney on child poverty. Last year, ACOS identified around 17% of Australian children as living below the poverty line. And this past week, the Progress 2013 conference took place in Melbourne. The guests included Richard Wilkinson, author with Kate Pickett of The Spirit Level, Why More Equal Societies Almost Always Do Better. Well, tonight Peter Wilkinson will join us together with a couple of friends, including Cassandra Goldie of ACOS, and of course you too. Right now, another serious challenge. As I indicated, rich is the country that has plenty of poor people. That's a line from Joseph Heller, full of quotes on this topic tonight. Heller wrote that about 17th century Holland. But is it an economic truth? Does great prosperity require abundant poverty? In Australia, in 2010, 17% of children lived below the poverty line. Can we afford it? Joining us in the studio, it's a great pleasure to welcome Cassandra Goldie, CEO of ACOS, the Australian Council on Social Services. Cassandra, great to have you.
Good evening, John. Great to be here.
And in our Melbourne studio, we're joined by Bianca Pozzano, a single mother with twin boys. Bianca, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you for having me today.
And also the author of The Spirit Level, a book I mentioned in the introduction, The Spirit Level, Why More Equal Societies Almost Always Do Better, Richard Wilkinson. Richard, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Richard, I mentioned some figures about poverty levels in Australia. I also read during the week that in the great industrial city of Birmingham in England, recent poverty levels child health levels show that the infant mortality rate is higher than that in Cuba. From your understanding, what's happening in Western societies?
Well, I think that infant mortality is highly sensitive to social and economic conditions and is damaged by greater inequality. And Britain has become a more unequal society. Both Britain and the United States are amongst the more unequal societies in the rich world. And places like Cuba that are much more egalitarian, although they're much poorer, are catching up in health terms. Our position is slipping down the league table in terms of infant mortality or life expectancy.
Cassandra Goldie, infant mortality has been taken as really one of those baseline threshold measures of the health of sections of a population. It's used when we're talking about the developing world. Your figure, released a couple of years ago, of 17% of Australian children living beneath the poverty line. Is Australia, how does that compare to Australia in the past, and is Australia going down the path we see in countries like Britain and the USA?
Well, disturbingly, this is a rate that's on the rise, and I think that's a particular indictment on us because we have seen over two decades of strong economic growth in this country, and just this year, again, Credit Suisse found that we have the highest median wealth per household in the world.
Better than Norway.
So we're at the top. And whilst we're not as unequal as some of the other countries that Richard... refers to, we are trending in the wrong direction. So we're having greater wealth accumulated at the higher end. We've got a core group of people that's growing who absolutely are living in poverty. And, of course, we should all be really concerned about that. And I think that there is this notion that somehow the people who are poor will always be with us. But I've got to say it's very clear to us why this is happening, and it is absolutely within our control to be able to reduce and ultimately eliminate that rate.
I'm going to bring Bianca into the conversation in a moment to get some feeling of what it's like to be at the end of this train in Australia. But before we do that, Richard, let me ask you again, what led you to the conclusions you make in the spirit level? And to summarise that introduction or the subtitle of your book, The Spirit Level, Why More Equal Societies Almost Always Do Better?
Well, I worked for a long time trying to understand the very large social class differences in death rates that exist in almost every country, and gradually began to see the importance of income differences, and then noticing that more unequal societies, that is, countries with bigger income differences between rich and poor, did worse not only in terms of measures of health, but also a whole range of other social problems. So not only is life expectancy in more unequal countries lower, but there's more mental illness, there's much more violence measured by homicide rates, community life deteriorates, people trust each other less, social cohesion declines, child well-being declines, a whole range of things like that. And the differences between how well or badly more and less equal societies do is very large indeed. I mean, you find infant mortality or mental illness twice or three times as high in more unequal societies, but things like teenage birth rates, the proportion of the population in prison, and in some studies, measures of homicide, rates are 10 times as high in more unequal societies. And these differences are so big because it's not just the poor who are affected by inequality. It damages the whole social fabric of a society. And so even reasonably well-off and well-educated middle-class people do less well, are more likely to be victims of violence, or will live a bit shorter lives in more unequal societies. So in that sense, we're all affected.
Many people would say, well, of course, if you're comparing the developing world with the developed world, you've got absolute rates of poverty which push people down to the starvation level. Of course those figures are going to be higher in those countries. But what you're suggesting is your book, it's not about absolute poverty, it's about relative difference.
Yes, in the rich countries, these problems seem to be unaffected by absolute levels of income. So countries like Australia, United States, Norway, the richest of the developed countries, don't do any better than countries like Greece, Portugal, Israel, the poorer of the developed countries. You see no relationship with average incomes. But where you do see relationships with income is within our societies. So there's an extraordinary gradient in all these health and social problems across societies related to differences in relative income. It's about social status, where we are in relation to each other and the size of the gaps between us. That's what now matters in the rich world. In poorer countries, certainly, it's really important that they should have higher material standards, but that's no longer true in the rich world. It's the differences between us that count.
One other question relating to that is it in part due to the fact that in poorer countries you still have communal bonds that are very strong because there are no other sorts of infrastructure? Then you have a strong sense of local community and support in those societies.
That helps, but I'm not saying that income inequality doesn't matter in poorer countries. I'm saying that the absolute standard of living also matters in those poorer countries. Inequality is also damaging. I mean, take a a country like South Africa with appallingly large income differences. It has amongst the highest levels of violence, and its health is worse than you'd expect for its levels of average income. But when you talk about community, one of the real damages that inequality inflicts is that community life withers. People withdraw from community life. Social cohesion goes down. We don't trust each other so much. Violence goes up. So it's not that social cohesion is something independent. It's so powerfully influenced by inequality. And basically all I'm saying is that that intuition that people have had since, I suppose, around the time of the French Revolution or earlier, that inequality is divisive and socially corrosive, basically now we can compare the data for different countries, we see that that intuition is astonishingly true.
Cassandra Goldie, the debate in countries such as Australia tends to swing according to the fashions of the moment between carrot and stick. That is, if you have problems with people with unemployment, for example, the question is whether it's encouragement or discipline that needs to be exercised. Are those concepts even relevant any longer when you look at the thesis as being proposed by Richard and others?
Well, I think that we've seen in the last few years, I think particularly since the GFC, a slight shift in the discussion that's going on in Australia about who is unemployed and what that means for people, in that I think we've seen less of the stereotyping that we might have seen in past times, because I think that whilst we didn't get hit in the same way as many of the other countries with vast numbers of people falling out of paid work, people have been really worried about that. So I think there's a growing sensitivity to what it could be like, but I don't think I am very concerned that unless we have a very cohesive discussion between business and the community sector, that we will see a return to a pretty major divide in this discussion, because times are going to get more difficult. We've seen a drop-off in our revenue. We know that there is a pressure across the budget on a number of fronts, and we're very concerned that we might see, again, a shift to blaming of people who are struggling, blaming them for being unable to succeed, when in fact it is very structural what's going on here. I mean, the reason that people are living below the poverty line, we've got these increasing rates of child poverty, is because there were decisions to not increase the unemployment payment in real terms. So that's $35 a day. It's the lowest in the OECD in relative terms. So when we talk about inequality, you don't get more unequal than that. And then also for households with children, the family payment system, which has been so important in protecting us from major crises in child poverty, that has been withering on the line. So Bob Hawke, you remember his famous...
No child shall live in poverty.
And he succeeded. 1990,
I think.
He said it in 1987. That no child would live in poverty by 1990. And during his term as Prime Minister, he was successful in reducing the rate of child poverty by 30%. And that is not to be maligned. That is to be really investigated. And what he did was he increased the family payments so that they kept up with wages. So this comes back to Richard's theme about the need for there to be... basic social safety net keeps up in relative terms with the shift in wages over time.
That almost is a beautiful segue to a discussion with Bianca, somebody who's had to live with the sort of existing social structures and payments. Bianca, I'll ask you a question in a moment, but one final question to Cassandra before I move to having a yarn with you about what it's like to live at this level. How important is income as a measure? What are the key measures? Because ACOS has always also said something earlier about affordable housing, and welcomed a statement by the Minister Kevin Andrews in looking at housing. What are the traditional measures that we're talking about here?
Well, the traditional measure for poverty, relative poverty, is 50%. If you're living below, your income is below 50% of the median wage in the country. So that's a fairly conservative, widely accepted measure. But what we have done in our most recent analysis is to take into account the housing costs, because we know that that is the major definer when it comes to expenses. That's the cost of living problem, John. There's a lot of rhetoric around about cost of living. Well, the cost of living issue is actually about our housing costs, and that is the major divide. So if you factor in housing costs, you will see that, for example, the rates of poverty amongst older people, people relying on the age pension, is lower because at the moment we still have a lot of people who manage to pay off their own home. Increasingly, of course, that won't be the case as people move out of paid work and will be not able to rent in the private rental market.
You've got two issues there going on. You've got a generational shift with the housing thing, that is, the under-40s are finding it very difficult to get into the market. You've got something else happening, which appears to be the beginning of structural change away from manufacturing, or the acceleration of that. You've had bad news in Geelong this week again, second time within 12 months. In that sort of environment, this, I guess, reinforces what you're saying about the need for, so if you're going to go through structural transition, the need for some sort of threshold support level.
There needs to be a threshold support level, absolutely. So that's the safety net. But also you need to invest in the community development future planning work that needs to be done. One of the concerns we've got about the approach to industry assistance is it tends not to include community-level decision-makers who are best placed to be looking not only to how to save a particular industry, but about the future of the population that lives in that locality. And so one of the major calls for us as the community sector is to not be seen as the welfare groups that pick up the pieces that are left, you know, when people are left behind, but to be in the major decisions about where we should be spending our money at this time when we are seeing these kinds of structural changes, which are inevitable.
Bianca, let me bring you into the conversation here. You've been very patient. You were a single mother with twin boys. You've been living on Newstart. You were on a single parent benefit, I understand, and you moved to Newstart. First of all, what was the level that you were on with the single parent benefit, and what's the gap that you now that you've now moved to?
Okay. Well, currently I'm working full time, but I have lived on Newstart this year in between contract work. So last year when I was on the single parent payment, I was working, and the single parenting payment supplemented my income. So I was able to work part-time and support my kids financially and study part-time.
So what was your take-home pay?
It would be really hard to describe that because it includes my income also from working.
But it was enough.
A part-time job.
Yeah, it was enough to get by.
It was enough to get by. Yes, yeah. It was enough to definitely get by, and that it's always a struggle being a single parent financially, but I felt supported, and I felt that the supplemental income on single parent payment definitely aided with me being able to be that single parent and support my kids properly. But being shoved onto Newstart at the start of this year in between contract work led a fluctuation in my payments where I was looking at approximately about $160 less per week in income, and in a struggling family situation, that means that is the cost of a grocery bill that affects your ability to pay rent.
So what real impact did that have on your standard of living? What was the consequence of that?
Well, psychologically, I felt beaten down by the government. I felt really hurt because I've always worked hard and I've always done my very best to contribute to society and study and do the right thing. And so one of the first things that happened at the start of this year when I was slugged with Newstart was that I had to sit my twin boys down and tell them, look, the first thing that's going is sporting activities and playing cricket with your friends on the weekend, because I can't seem to afford to pay for those fees because I'm struggling to make bill payments. The electricity bill isn't being paid. I'm struggling with rental payments. I'm in between contract work. I'm studying, and I was facing exams at that time. I was studying law, and that was my focus, was to pass those exams and look for full-time work, because living on Newstart is just not possible as a sole parent at all.
1300 800 222 is the number to ring. If you'd like to give us a call on Sunday night, share your thoughts with Bianca, a single mother with twin boys and one who has learning difficulties, and your thoughts about Newstart, other things in our society. Where are we going? Structural change? Do we need better support levels? Is it the case that, in your understanding, societies need a little more care and equity, or a little less, carrot or stick? 1300 800 222 is the number to call on Sunday nights on ABC Radio around Australia, through Radio Australia, John, via the web to the world. Richard.
John, yes, I wonder. I think mostly people think of poverty just in terms of having too little money to make ends meet. I think Bianca, she strikes me as a very well-sorted single parent who perhaps avoids some of the worst psychological effects. But I read a study just recently of poverty in India, Uganda, the UK and Norway. And the poor in those different societies were living at quite different levels. I mean, in India, there were people in huts with no running water, no sewerage, nothing like that, just earth floors. In Uganda, I think they were looking at rural poverty, but still people with earth-floored huts. In UK and Norway, the poor people with two or three bedroomed, often centrally heated houses, DVDs and so on. And yet the experience of poverty at those very different levels was remarkably similar. A sense of being stigmatized, of being failures, being looked down on, a sense of shame at not being able to provide for your children adequately or as you'd like to, fathers feeling almost suicidal about not being able to provide for their families. And you see, what is important about poverty as relative poverty, as I said, where you are in relation to other people and the inequality that creates that sort of hierarchy, is the feelings of superiority at the top and inferiority at the bottom. People feeling that they're judged by where they are in society, looked down on. It's those sort of psychological things that are as important as the material effects.
Is that culture of blame, Richard, that we alluded to earlier, common in the United States and Britain as it has been in Australia? It was called the Dole Bludger effect in Australia.
Yes, I think it is. One of the things that inequality does is you look down on the people below you. You know, the prejudiced view is that the poor are poor because they're stupid and lazy. And, you know, similarly, we used to regard the rich, the bankers, as brilliant before the crash. We tend to judge people's abilities and worth from their position in society. And recently, studies have shown that amongst the biggest 100 multinationals in Britain, the average pay difference is about 300 to 1 between the CEO and the most junior full-time worker. And if you imagine people being paid one-third of 1% of what the CEO is being paid, there's no more powerful way of telling a whole bunch of people you are almost worthless than to pay them a third of 1% of what someone else is getting in the same company. And then, you know, people come along and start saying, well, the problem with the poor is low self-esteem. And, of course, it's being created by those differences that give rise to different ideas of people's worth.
Richard, I was I was very fortunate to be on the panel with Richard yesterday at the Progress Conference. So good to hear your voice and the thoughts. And Bianca, the first time I met Bianca was on the protest bus as we travelled from Sydney down to Canberra to make a final stand before the government passed, the previous government passed this legislation to move the single parents onto the unemployment payment. And I think one of the most devastating parts of it that I took from everybody that was affected by it was exactly what Richard's talking about, which is that sense that because nobody had any knowledge that this was going to be proposed, let alone an opportunity to comment upon the proposal before it was announced in the budget. I got a call the night before the announcement, and certainly people such as Bianca had no opportunity to share with the government what the impact of this might have been.
Cassandra,
and I contrast this with how the government would treat the mining companies if they were about to go ahead with tax changes. And I note that the new government is proceeding down that path. For example, with their tax changes, they're going to be consulting with industry. And we're still unclear about to what extent people such as Bianca and the people that represent her will be included in those sorts of discussions and treated equally in terms of the decisions that are going to be made.
Bianca, Cassandra, you had an opportunity during the Progress Conference this past week, but also since the Labor Party lost office as government, to chat with some politicians about that. I mean, Wayne Swan, I understand, was at the Progress Conference. Did anybody say to him, why on earth did you do that? Why on earth were you prepared ethically to tolerate such poverty-level conditions for people who were on benefits?
Well, I know that this was a very hotly debated issue within caucus. I do know that. It was always very difficult, frankly, to pin down who was particularly supportive of making these changes and whether it was ideological or whether it was financial. I think it was a mix of both. And without naming names, I think there was a very clear drive to try and deliver a surplus. And I think that was one of the most offending aspects of this change, was that for people like Bianca, who was out there working and doing a stunning job of looking after her children, doing your law degree, part-time work as well, to be told that this was going to be good for you because by putting you onto a lower payment would motivate you to get out and get paid work was frankly just offensive. Mm.
The psychological impact, Bianca.
Yeah, look, it was really devastating, and I did feel offended. Definitely, Cassandra, you're right on the money there. And I know that I'm not the only one. And the thing for me is that I've had the privilege to speak to a lot of single parents through the Single Parents Action Group and through my own networks. And the common denominator here for me psychologically is that we're all disheartened. We feel like we're already working so hard and we're dealing with kids that are already suffering because they have only one parent who is doing most of the work. And they're either working long hours and many, many shift work, and their kids are in school and before school care and after school care if they're privileged enough to access decent and accessible childcare that is affordable to them. And these kids are coming home after 12-hour days and they have to sit down and do homework. And for my kids, you know, they don't have the mental energy to go through a homework exercise after a 12-hour day. And it's disheartening. It really is, because we do work really hard.
And Bianca, the story about you know, your need to trade off the money to for your kids to do sport is a really common story. And for us, we, you know, you do have to wonder where a country that is so aware of the issues of health, impact of obesity for children, to not factor in that this is what this means for those families. That it's, and it's not that the parents, this is the idea that, you know, people who don't have a lot of money, you know, don't understand about how to, you know, provide for a healthy environment for their children. That's not our experience and observation at all. But these days in public schools and private schools, you have to pay if your children are going to participate in sporting activity.
You're on Sunday Night, time to take some calls. First on the line, however, we do have an old friend of Sunday Night, somebody who has an active interest in the discussion as the head of one of the major church welfare agencies in the arena, and that's Lynn Hatfield Dodds of Uniting Care. Lynn, you've just got off a plane. You're in Nullarbor, I understand.
I have, John. G'day. I'm in East Arnhem Land at the moment.
Lynn, you've had a chance to hear a little of what we've said. What was Uniting Care's response to the way the government implemented the New Start allowance from single parent, and what do you think was in their mind in doing it?
Oh, look, I think Cassandra's right. I mean, it's conjecture. None of us sat around the cabinet table. But I suspect, the government was looking to save money and this seemed a way to do it. The other thing that often gets lost in this debate, of course, is what we were talking about with that change was moving 80 to 90,000 single parents from parenting payment to New Start. But for a while, new entrants who would have been accessing parenting payment had been going on to New Start. So already coming into our services across communities, you've had a two-tiered system. So I think in some senses the government were looking to save money, and I think there was an imperative there to put everybody on an even footing. What would have been lovely is to put everybody on an even, better remunerated footing, because it's hard enough to make ends meet on a parenting payment. You can't do it on New Start. What I wanted to say, though, listening to the conversation, I absolutely endorse everything that's been said around the impossibility of payments, and we must look at those as a country. But I had a very interesting couple of hours with our National Children's Commissioner the other week in Sydney, Megan Mitchell, and she's been doing a tour right around country listening to children. And what children who are experiencing poverty particularly talk about as front of their mind is family violence. So I think that's part of the picture that we often don't see. We think about neglect, we think about missed opportunities, think about all the difficulties of the lived experience of poverty. But what I found fascinating was when children have their own voice, what they're talking about is family violence in the home.
But to talk about family violence, I don't know whether Lynn meant to suggest it was independent of these problems of poverty and being stigmatised and so on, but there's no doubt at all that living in poverty, living at the bottom of the social ladder, puts enormously much more stress on family life and increases conflict.
And we know that with the way that rental prices have gone in all of the urban centres where most of the work is, the insecurity of not being able to keep a roof over your family's head is very devastating for those people. And so I think the pressure becomes intense, particularly when there is really, you are doing everything possible to try and improve your economic situation. There are not enough jobs around. I mean, that's the truth of it. We know that, for people who are now out of paid work, it's really hard to get back in. We've got a growth in long-term unemployment that's affecting young people, older people, single parents, parents generally as well, and people with disability. So we do need to have a respect for people to say, well, the truth is for some people you will be having to rely on income support because we do not have enough paid work for people who want it.
I'd like to come back to that issue of jobs in a few moments, but Lynn Hatfield Dodds, before we let you go, where are Uniting Care on this? Are you sort of going to approach the new government with a stated position on particularly the levels of poverty in Australia and the position regarding children in poverty?
Oh, absolutely. And, I mean, the new government understands our position because we worked with them when they're in opposition. So the Uniting Care position is one that comes out of our coalface experience working with families and with children across Australia. And it's simply that there are far too many children living in poverty and we need to do something about it. So that will include looking at the welfare system, and we've welcomed the fact that the government's looking at reviewing welfare. But if we're going to do that seriously, and when you look at the government's commission of audit, it would be relatively easy to redistribute some of the money that's tied up in superannuation benefits going to very wealthy people, and there's a whole bunch of things people could do. But we also need, and Cassandra said this earlier, we also need to look very seriously about how to strengthen families and households and communities to be places that are safe for children to grow and thrive. If we're serious about addressing our structurally ageing population and we believe we need to have a participation agenda, we want to be a smart country, then not to invest really strongly in children and making sure that no child is left behind and no child is left out and that every child can reach their full potential seems to me to be a critical part of a forward-thinking government's agenda, or it ought to be.
And this is the deep tragedy of it, where we have secured a relative agreement that there needs to be investment into our education system, that the number of children who are not achieving the kind of educational outcomes that we want to see is growing and is essentially on a similar level to the number of children living below poverty, below the poverty line. So for us, we need to recognise that child well-being begins on day one in a family home, and by the time children get to school, if they're living in these kinds of situations with parents who are really struggling to try and deliver for them what they need in their early years, then they're behind the eight ball by the time they get to school.
Lynn Hatfield-Dodds, thank you so much for joining us on Sunday night. We'll let you go. You've got a very busy day, obviously, in front of you in the Northern
Good
Territory.
Good to hear from you, Lynn.
Thanks for your observations.
And you guys. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Lynn Hatfield-Dodds, the National Director of Uniting Care there. Let's say hello to Barry in Mount Isa. Hi, Barry. What would you like to say?
Oh, yes. Just a few general comments. I mean, I agree with what most of the panel have said, that if you're going to maintain social stability and community security, you've got to have a general sense of fair play and equity within society. I mean, I have nothing against people who are wealthy or even extremely wealthy, but I would like to think that they would have a general concern at some stage for those people who are on the bottom of life's, for lack of an expression, shit pile. So, I mean, if you want things to remain calm and orderly in a society, you can't have the vast majority of society or a significant proportion of society suffering or being disadvantaged to a large degree.
Barry, thanks for your observations. Cassandra, do you want to respond, Barry?
I do in a couple of points there, Barry. I think one of our big mistakes is to stereotype anybody. My observation is that individuals, some people who have are very wealthy, have a very strong recognition of the need for themselves to pay more tax. They know that the way that our tax system is working at the moment is delivering far too generous kicks for themselves and not delivering for the more general population. I think the other part of it is, and this comes back to the theme from Richard, that everybody loses when we don't have a more fair and equal society, that The ways in which dysfunction plays out for people who are struggling can be seen in a number of different ways. But equally, the more we divide ourselves and we have people who have no sense of the connection to caring, I think we do also see increasing rates of depression, increasing rates of drug use, and this is in households where they're significantly wealthy. So the rates in which drinking is occurring in Australia is a major concern. So I think we need to be careful here in not stereotyping that it's the people who don't have a lot of money who are the ones who are really struggling to deliver on the basics in terms of community, when in fact I think this potentially impacts right through sort of the social structures.
We need to move on, Barry. Thanks for your observations. We're going to say hi to Jody in Glebe. Hello, Jody.
Yes, hi. Look, I've got a different angle on things. One major issue I think that really is disadvantaging people trying to fight for a better deal in the social welfare system is that we not only don't have any politicians that I know of who've recently, if ever, been on social welfare payments. Most of them, if they've ever been on any kind of welfare payment, it's probably university student payment. But also, I was a journalist for many, many decades on major papers. And I then, after taking a break from journalism, I was unexpectedly widowed and within a year had to become a full-time carer for Dad with Parkinson's and dementia. I'm lucky I've got work skills. I was able to go straight back into the workforce after 10 years away, but I do a lot of lobbying for carers. And I have yet to find anybody in the media who has ever been on welfare, apart from maybe when they were a student. They certainly don't have any recent awareness of what it's like to be on a welfare payment. And so you get a problem where you get, for instance, stereotyping of welfare recipients, such as carers. You also just basically get a real lack of awareness of what it's actually like to be out there. I'll give you one example of an issue that I've been trying to get some coverage of. When I heard the announcement of Tony Abbott's plans for women on maternity leave, and my background is I was in the women's movement when I was a teenager, so I was one of the people who fought for maternity leave. The point that I've been trying to make, and I tried to make to Abbott directly at a community meeting, is that you're setting up a two-tiered system of support for women who are mothers. If you're a woman who has a, inverted commas, normal child and is only out of the workforce for a short time, under his program, you're getting at least the minimum wage and some degree of super. If you're a woman who has a disabled child and basically has to leave the workforce for the rest of your life, you not only don't get super, you don't get even the basic wage. Now, I discovered when I was a carer that the reason that carers don't get super or even the minimum wage is because you're not legally classified as a worker. So that was the final insult for me, was discovering that, you know, every year you get the politicians throwing out the platitudes during Carers Week, saying, you know, how carers are the hardest working people in the Australian community. But you're not even legally classified as a worker.
Yes, we're going to have to... Jodie, we've got the point you made. Sorry to compress it.
No one in the media seems to be interested in picking up on this inequity.
Got your 2 points. I'm sorry to have to cut you off, but okay. I will get a brief comment from Cassandra on both of those, because you were quite eloquent, Jodie, in explaining it.
And look, Jodie, the valuing of unpaid caring work is one of the hottest issues for us as a country. And it's a very feminised issue, as you know, not solely, but we certainly see that across the community, it is more typically women who will be the ones who make the decision not to be in paid work or have no choice but to be out of paid work in order to look after a loved one or a dependent person. And there is, at the moment, no structural way to properly recognise that and to make sure that those people do not face significant poverty in later life. You know, the life living on the income support system, but then in that post, you know, working life, to have not secured any superannuation at all. And this is why we are very concerned that at the moment, with the Commission of Audit underway, we've had it confirmed that the Commission of Audit won't be looking at tax expenditure. So they're the tax dollars lost when it comes to negative gearing or capital gains or superannuation, but that all of the, in quotes, welfare expenditure is on the table. So, I think that we've got the conversation the wrong way around.
I think that what Jodie was saying about people in the media and politicians not having experience of living on welfare and so on is absolutely true and important. Increasingly in our different countries, politicians tend to be professional politicians, very few with manual working backgrounds, as used to be the case. And nearly everyone commenting in the media, journalists and so on, are people in the top few percent of the income distribution. You know, the vast majority of them in the richest 5%.
Richard, there's an observation, just a brief observation, on with regard to that. We've seen in Australia over recent days, we mentioned earlier, the decline in manufacturing industry. We've seen in the last week announcements with regard to Qantas and Geelong and engineering jobs that are previously regarded as highly skilled technical jobs. Are we seeing, if we are seeing a structural shift in workforces around the world, it's usually met by a rhetorical stance of, oh, yes, we've got to skill up everybody for the new world of work, not the old world of work. It seems to beg a question, that is, are there not substantial numbers in the population who will not be able to be skilled up for the new world of work? That is, are we at risk of introducing not just structural poverty, but a sort of structural employment, a sort of base-level employment, casualised employment, in which we are building societies which cannot be other than that?
I think people have always thought that the sort of new demands were perhaps of the productive system, ones that people weren't going to be able to meet. I'm quite sure in the 19th century they felt that you couldn't get more than about half the population literate. Teacher reading and writing probably thought it was beyond others. But more important, I think, is that this competition between nations, which so often actually is a race to the bottom, and any of the productivity improvements in our societies, instead of meaning we all do less work and have more time for friends and family and community, what happens is that labour is shed, so some people are unemployed, and we take the benefits of productivity in terms of higher standards of consumerism and so on for the ones in employment. The New Economics Foundation in London is talking about how we should be moving towards a 21-hour week. I can't remember quite how they established that as the figure, but we must take the benefits of increased productivity in future in terms of by having more leisure. But the problem is that in the more unequal a society, the more consumerism, because consumerism is about status competition. And so people in more unequal societies work longer hours and they spend more of their income, they save less, they get into debt more, because money is how you show what you're worth. And that's what the connection between inequality and consumerism, which is, of course, also a connection with the difficulty of moving towards sustainability, in that consumerism is the big threat to sustainability. That's the crucial area we have to sort out.
And, of course, if we don't address it, Bianca, I'll just get your comment briefly on this. Poverty mm-hmm. becomes generational, and you must have been concerned about that with your kids.
Yes, of course. And a lot of sole parents that I've spoken to have come from a generation of kids living in poverty. And right now I feel really ashamed to see that in Australia this is how we're treating our kids, and we're not recognising that we're forcing kids to keep in poverty traps, and we're growing up in a society where consumerism is shoved down their throat because of the inequality. They're going to school and they're comparing themselves to the kids. So if they're not able to go to school camp because the fees aren't able to be paid, then they're going to feel like they can't be a part of the group, that they don't have the right shoes. And these things stem and they grow into bigger problems and push them into a psychological whirlwind where they're feeling like they're inadequate and forcing them into that trap.
And the Bianca, last 30 seconds are yours, Cassandra.
Yeah, I just I think that the point about the casualisation of the workforce is a big one for Australia. And Bianca, you'd know that really well from all the mums you've spoken to, that the desperation to get something that's actually secure and reliable so that you can organise the rest of your life around that. I think that in the debates at the moment in terms of economic policy, there's far too much focus on big business. And we need to be looking again at investing in community enterprise, where a lot of the jobs will be found if we're prepared to do that.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/Sunday Nights with an S. Thank you for listening.